Hello and welcome once again to the What the Flick podcast. We are still at my dining room table. I'm trying to make it less echoey. How's that? Is that better?
Sure.
Alonzo is here. Alonzo Duralli is here. I am here. My name is Christy Lemire. We are still at the dining room table. We are still figuring this thing out.
Yes. And we appreciate everybody who's reached out on Twitter and other places to let us know they're still listening to the show. We would love to make this available on a more convenient feed, but we have some stuff to iron out first. So we know, and we're thinking about it, and we're not ignoring it, but we're just not there yet. So in the meantime, come to ChristyLemire.com for all this fabulousness.
And somebody, one of our followers, says you can just like strip the link and turn it into an MP3, which is way more high tech than I know how to do anything with. So.
Yeah, I think if you like right click, maybe you can save as an MP3. I don't know, but there's ways to do it.
Anyway, if you guys figure it out, let us know. In the meantime, we have a jam-packed week, as we so often do. It is September. We've got a mix of, you know, stuff that matters and stuff that thinks it matters. And we're going to talk about all of it.
Yeah, it's weird. There's that early part of award season where you can tell that it's sort of like, all right, we're just going to burn these off. We thought they had a they were going to be fall contenders, and maybe they aren't going to be. So now we're just going to, like, you know. We'll give them an actual autumn release, but then we're just going to scurry out of the way once the really heavy hitters start popping up later in the season.
Yes. So you can see the ambition of a film like, let's just start with Life Itself.
Oh, sure.
Because we made ourselves go see it last night. Alonzo and Dave and I all went to actually see it last night
at
the Grove.
Yes.
We had heard from when it played at, was it?
TIFF.
Was it play at Toronto?
Yeah.
And, you know, given who it's from, given who stars in it, given its themes, it would seem to be a lofty award season offering. However.
Ooh. And the initial buzz out of TIFF was pretty murderous. To the extent that people were calling it this year's The Book of Henry or Collateral Beauty. And that's catnip for me, you know, like a wildly ambitious but deranged failed film. Like, yes, you know, give me that. This is not that. This is just kind of boring. So it's a Dan Fogelman joint. He's the guy who created This Is Us. He did Crazy Stupid Love. And, you know, he has a bag of tricks and they are on display here. And he loves the sort of seemingly unrelated characters that wind up being related, which is a thing that doesn't work when you realize that there's only a certain number of characters, and so there's only a certain number of permutations in which you're going to be able to connect those dots. And so Christy very proudly, midway through the film, called a big Act 3 moment, and Dave and I were like, yeah.
I was very proud of myself for staying awake and paying attention.
The staying awake part is tricky, because, yeah, this movie is a slog, and it's a full 2 hours, right?
It is all of 2 hours.
Yeah, brother. So we begin with a very sad Oscar Isaac, and he is in therapy sessions with Annette Bening that the court is requiring him to do. He's been institutionalized for a while. And the movie very quickly and very frequently introduces the notion of the unreliable narrator. And this is one of those movies where writers talk about writing. And that's a thing that can occasionally work, but for the most part is just super self-indulgent. And I think writers use it as an excuse, like that if something grandiose or misguided happens in the film, like, well, no, because that's what the writer would do, and it's how it's being written, and I'm writing about writing. And
that can be great in a film like Adaptation.
Sure. Yeah.
It's smart and it's clever and it toys with its self-knowing nature. And this is not that.
This is definitely not that. And, you know, this is the kind of movie where they say the title more than once.
It is a drinking game. And it's also unfortunate that the title happens to share the name with the documentary and the memoir from Roger Ebert.
Yes, which is a far better use of your time. So, you know, we get to know the tragic backstory of Oscar Isaac's character. He had been married to Olivia Wilde, who was his college sweetheart. She was pregnant. And then we meet other characters and seemingly random characters. And what could they possibly have to do with the rest of the story? I wonder. So, at some points we're with Mandy Patinkin, who plays Oscar Isaac's father, and then we're off to Spain with Antonio Banderas, who runs an olive plantation. It's the kind of, I remember just watching the trailer and thinking, oh, this is one of those movies that thinks it has these just sort of lofty insights about life, and it's such a mystery and such a miracle, but this movie has nothing to say about anything.
It is empty and pat and trite, and the characters, there's just nothing to them. I mean, you know, we have multiple manic pixie dream girls here.
Yes.
Olivia Wilde chief among them, you know. And it's so frustrating to see just the wealth of talent on display.
Being squandered.
And these people who undergo really traumatic life events. I mean, this movie truly does try to get its arms around, like, the cycle of life and birth and death and major moments in between that define you, and don't just define you, but like the characters then have to spell out the fact that these are moments that are defining you. And it feels so empty, and never once does it achieve the emotion that it is going after.
No.
I mean, there are things in here, there are beats and themes in here that ordinarily I suspect would move you and me.
Oh yeah. If you are going to give me a movie with a cancer mom, like, you are halfway there. I lost my mother to cancer when I was, you know, in my teens. That's always a very sensitive subject for me. A lot of times I've seen it in movies. And even a movie that's not great, if they do that part right, I will be a sobbing heap. Like Diane Wiest in Bright Lights, Big City, for instance. Even frickin' Stepmom, for a moment, you know, managed to get me. This movie unpacks that cliche, and I was just completely not into it.
Right.
Not feeling a thing, not responding to anything, because there's no human being in this movie.
There's no truth to what they're exploring.
It's
this
collection of types and tropes, and it's very glib when it wants to be, you know, thoughtful and emotional, and it's a crock. And the fact that writer-director Dan Fogelman decided that he was going to go after straight white film critics for being afraid of emotion, which is such a fake woke, like somebody told him that there's too many white guys reviewing movies, and so that was going to be that was the card he was going to play. And I love all the female critics online going, no, we hate it too.
Right, yeah. Dan Fogelman in the same interview also referred to fancy filmmakers who saw this and liked it, and I'd love to know who the fancy filmmakers are who enjoyed this. Yeah, I am a woman. I did not like this.
I'd say you're a fancy woman.
Today I'm not fancy, although wait till you guys see what we're wearing. I'm not going to spoil it. I'm going to just let you wait and see. But it has cancer mom, but also there's a thing that would ordinarily get to me, which as the mother of a little boy, mm-hmm. you know, there are moments here that ordinarily should get to me. I lost my parents when I was pretty young too. I was 23 and 25 when they died. So yeah, I'm with you in that can often really get to me in films that are not worthy of that emotion. That did not work for me either. Every once in a while, there was a glimmer of something kind of interesting. There is a monologue that Antonio Banderas gives.
That's the one high point of the film. And it's not even that the monologue is all that good. It's just the way he delivers it.
Right. The way, yeah. And this is a moment in which Dan Fogelman knows to, like, leave well enough alone and just let a masterful actor do what he does.
Totally.
And he just holds the camera on him for long chunks of time, letting Antonio Banderas tell the story, which isn't really all that interesting. It's a pretty inane story. You know, it's his backstory.
Yeah, but he sells it.
But he sells it. He's got such tremendous presence.
And it's nice that he leaves the camera still, because there's so much sort of gimmicky effects work in this movie where people will walk through their own memories, or multiple versions of one person pops up in a flashback, or a camera will sort of zip around a kitchen every time it goes behind a column and then comes back out again. Everyone's a little bit older, you know, stuff like that. It's like, which in the service of an actual story or actual characters could be effective, but here it's just sort of like, oh, that's neat. But it doesn't illuminate anything, and there's no human being here for it to actually tell you anything about.
Right. One thing that distracted me the whole time, and I wanted to wait until now to ask you about it, is The Passage of Time.
Oh, yes.
What year is it? It's so confusing.
Yeah, we're given 1 year. We are told specifically that the Olivia Wilde character was born in 1985.
Right, and then she's in college.
So by the time they're married, we should assume that it's about like 2011 or so?
Maybe. Well, he asked her at a fraternity party while they're still in school. There's a sign. There's some like beer fest sign on one of the fake fraternity walls, and it says 2006. Okay, so at that point,
okay, so they're
like 21. Maybe they get married like the next year and okay. have a baby like the next year, but then the baby.
But so then 21 years pass. So we're now in the late 2020s at the earliest.
Well, yes. Let's say they have the baby in 2008.
Yeah. It's
right.
2029.
So it's 2029 when at the point that their child is 21.
Yeah.
And then there's another character who is that person's child.
Yeah, exactly.
Who is doing a book reading at a bookstore with actual books. So you mean to tell me that in the year 2059... we're still going to be reading books like leather-bound, handsome volumes
maybe,
of books.
Maybe it'll be like vinyl, where like it's the one store and they have all the different kinds, you know, and it's kind of a, you know, it's a sort of a hipster fetish object, but not a mainstream, you know, in mainstream usage. Yeah, the movie, there's no attempt at depicting. Either like they could have dialed everything back so that it ends at the present, or they could have made a. I'm not saying that, you know, that in the last scene everybody needs to be wearing jetpacks, but I mean there's no effort at all to like indicate that time has passed.
Then they call it flight itself. There you go. But the thing is, the Oscar Isaac. I feel like the Oscar Isaac and Annette Bening storyline. I feel like it takes place in the present day because he's writing a screenplay on his laptop at a coffee house.
Yes.
Which feels like an effort to contemporize him.
Yes.
So that's like now, which means that their daughter is actually 21 years from now and is really like in the 2030s.
In the late 2030s, yeah.
Anyway, I shouldn't be thinking about these things.
Exactly.
And I was thinking about it constantly. I'm like, what the fuck year is it?
Yeah, when a movie starts has me do the math or looking at the lamps, then clearly it is not telling me a story that I care about.
Also, I'm sad to say this is not as batshit crazy as I wanted it to be.
No, it's like if you don't tell me that it's the new Book of Henry or the new Collateral Beauty and then have it just be this boring, like, I want it to be nuts.
Yeah, and we love those movies, and those are movies like they're terrible, but did we not tell everyone to go see
Absolutely.
Them? I would not tell anyone to go see this.
No. Yeah, this is not a Candy Bones movie at all.
Yeah, this is terrible. So terrible, but not even terrible enough.
Yeah. Just run-of-the-mill shitty.
And I wonder, like, what was Oscar Isaac thinking? Oscar Isaac usually chooses so beautifully, whether it is a juicy role in a Star Wars movie, or it's Inside Llewyn Davis, or it's Ex Machina, a really, you know, showy supporting role.
What is he thinking here? Yeah, I don't know. He was just in that Operation Finale movie, which I didn't see, but I heard good things about.
But solid, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm sure that he must have thought that he was going to get to play, like, the big emotions, you know, the joy and the grief and the da-da-da. This is the kind of movie where, like, characters talk about Bob Dylan in a way that no one has ever talked about music ever. And it's also, like, it just drove home for me, like, why I never got into Dylan. And it's not Dylan's fault. It's Dylan's fans' fault. Because you can't just like Dylan. You have to go talk about how he's, like, the modern-day Keats or whatever. And it's like, ugh, just, no, I'm not, you have ruined this for me. I'm not interested. You know, there's certain things where the fan base is such a turnoff, you know. It's like, part of the reason that I spent most of my life not watching Star Trek or Doctor Who is because it felt like you couldn't dabble. You know, you had to take a deep dive into that stuff.
You don't get it, man.
Exactly. And so yeah, they talk about Dylan and Tarantino, and it's just like, ugh. Yeah, no wonder straight white males are having a hard time understanding your movie, Dan Fogelman, when you talk about Dylan and Tarantino. How could they possibly?
I've never seen This Is Us, so I don't know if that is like a better use of his particular brand of schmaltz.
I've only seen the pilot, and it was an effective pilot, but again, it has the Fogelman tricks of like, it plays with time, and you don't know when it is, and you don't know who's connected to who or how, and then things are revealed. It's like, oh, wow, I didn't see that coming, you know. But I don't know how that holds up as a series, because I haven't watched it since then either. So.
Anyway.
But people love it.
Our good friend Robert Abley had a tremendous pun when he posted about this movie on Facebook. He called it, "This is Bus." Which, if you see the movie, you will understand what that means. All right, so anyway, I'm saying a 1.5 because Olivia Wilde is very pretty, and that one Antonio Banderas speech was pretty good.
Yeah, I'm giving it a 1 just for Antonio's moment. But yeah, other than that, I was bored, bored, bored.
Yeah, our number's a 1.3. It is at 12% currently on the tomato meter. Ooh. And it's been flirting with single digits. Mm. It was around 6, it was around 9, now it's at 12. I don't know who's going easy on it. The white male critics, apparently.
Yeah. Also, this is an Amazon film that has a reference to Amazon in the movie.
What was the Amazon reference?
When the Jean Smart, who plays Oscar Isaac's mother, is buying all this baby stuff, and Mandy's like, I got to tear down all the Amazon boxes.
Right.
And, stop it.
Yeah. So then the universe implodes upon itself.
Yeah. Well, and Oscar Isaac makes two different Star Wars references, so you know.
Oh yes, he does mention Chewbacca at one point. Okay. So our number's at 1.3. Don't see this movie is terrible.
No.
Let us move on.
No, in our pre-show, I forgot to mention one of my favorite movies of this year is opening this weekend, but I don't know if you've seen it. The Sisters Brothers.
I have not seen it because I had to make a choice last night after soccer practice. Do I go see Life Itself or do I go see Sisters Brothers?
Well, look, Life Itself is not going to be in theaters next week, but Sisters Brothers will be.
Let's catch up with it next week.
Absolutely.
Then.
We'll put a pin in that. Next week, we're definitely talking about Sisters Brothers. We'll be talking about Tea with the Dames and Jane Fonda in 5 Acts, which premiere. It's getting some theatrical play this weekend, but it's premiering on HBO on Monday, and I imagine it'll be on HBO Go for a while, so we'll definitely circle back to all those next week.
Yes, Tea with the Dames is juicy. So let's talk about, you want to do Assassination Nation?
Sure.
Let's do that, which is also a one for you to describe, my friend.
Okay, so this is Sam Levinson. He's the son of Barry. And he directed a film called, I think, it's like Every Little Thing, like one of those titles you can never remember. I seem to recall walking out of it at Sundance. Not that it was terrible, it was just kind of whatever. But so this is a very, very stylish film. It is set in the small town of Salem. I get it. And it's about these four popular girls who are friends, and the town sort of implodes when somebody starts hacking into people's computers and releasing all of their deepest, darkest secrets. And so it's kind of like The Crow, not the Brandon Lee movie, but the 1940s Nazi occupation drama, Le Corbeau, by way of Jawbreaker. But it's, you know, there's a lot of, like, you know, four girls in formation walking toward the camera in slow-mo. There's a lot of, you know, split screen and use of red, white, and blue and, you know, things like that. It's super stylish and... you know, plot-wise, it kind of falls apart for me, but the style is so much fun that it kind of carries it across the finish line anyway.
And the style isn't just fun. Like, it's muscular. There's one incredible tour de force sequence involving a camera swirling around the outside of this really funky mid-century modern house that's a lot of glass. And
yes,
you see each young woman in a different room. And then the mom of...
Anika Nani Rose.
Right, of one of the girls. And they're hanging out, as they so often do, chatting, gossiping, and then one by one you realize that, like, the people in town are closing in on them. And so you have this kind of conspiratorial peek into what they're doing. There's also, like, a lascivious kind of voyeurism to it. And it's, you realize a little while in, like, oh, he hasn't broken yet. Or at least he's achieved the sensation that he hasn't broken yet.
Of an uninterrupted sequence,
In and out of different rooms and around the outside of the house and, like, through a driveway. And it's really cool. And, yeah, there's a lot of very swaggering, muscular, stylish camera work on display here. It moves really well. The fact that these four actresses aren't really all that well known is quite a help, I think, because it allows us to feel immersed in this very specific place. I feel like this is Heathers meets The Purge.
I've seen that description.
There's a lot of that, too, in that they are they're kind of bitchy, mean girls, and they have a very specific way of talking and relating to each other. But the setting that they are in is also a very recognizable kind of suburbia.
Right.
And then it escalates. It gets really violent.
And that's where it kind of falls apart for me, because, like, the world we're shown is so recognizable that when it gets nuts, like, there's that point where the sort of the fat, bigoted sheriff is like, well, the FBI has traced the hacking from her house, blah, blah, blah. And one of the girls says, then why aren't they here? And no one ever answers that. And it's kind of like, all right, yeah, why isn't the FBI here? Why is all this mayhem being, why is no one stopping it?
You know? Well, they're trying to say that this level of mayhem, this level of people turning against one another could happen anywhere, right? It could happen in your town. And that's why it's meant to be like mundane small town America.
But it escalates to such an extent and over such a lengthy period of time. You're like, when does the National Guard come in? You know, that's, again, I just sort of found myself going there. But I did admire what it's going after, and I really like the panache of it all. You know, it was shot by Marcel Reve, who shot, did you see White Dog, White God a couple years ago?
No.
The dog movie where they sort of like revolts.
No.
Oh, it's really good. You should check it out. I mean, it's terrifying. But anyway, yeah. So it's I love how this is put together. I definitely want to give a shout out to an actress named Hari Neff, who is a trans actress. She's on Transparent, playing a trans character, the likes of which I don't know that I've really seen in a mainstream movie before. Like, she is very unapologetic. She is comfortable with who she is, and you know, with what she's about and what she wants. And there are boys who are attracted to her, but of course are, like, you know,
closeted,
and yeah, they're, you know, this whole crazy notion of, like, oh, if you're into a trans girl, that means you're gay, which is nuts, you know. But you know, again, I like the fact that this, you know, unlike a movie like Heathers, the central foursome are never turn on each other. They're always coming to each other's rescue, and they've got each other's back, and they're solidly, you know, sort of, you know, faithful to each other and making sure that they're all going to be okay in all this.
Yeah, I did not even realize for a little while that Hari Neff was a trans actress. I figured she was biologically a girl, like they all are, and until they make references, when they're in the pool, when they're swimming in the pool, and there's a reference to someone's dick or something, I think that was when I realized, okay. I just did not realize
gotcha.
That it was the case there. But she and Odessa Young, who was kind of the main leader of this foursome, have a really great, lovely, true chemistry with each other. There's a scene where Odessa Young's character is confessing to something, and it's all shot from underneath the sheets. Like they're lying side by side in a bed, and they're lying sideways looking at each other and underneath the sheets. And the connection, like the teen girl intensity of that connection, feels very true in that moment. The other two actresses are Abra and Suki Waterhouse. Joel McHale is good in this, in a very different role for Joel McHale.
Yeah.
Bella Thorne has a couple of very showy moments as, like, the vapid, bitchy head cheerleader girl at school. Mon Apatow has a small role in this as cheerleader also. Yeah, this is... it is surprising over and over again, stylishly, thematically, but then the screed at the end is kind of so scattershot. Like, whatever, she's kind of just going after everything that might plague teen girls in this moment in time, or plague women in general.
Sure.
And I don't know that its aim is all that precise in what it's trying to satirize by the end.
Yeah, I think I even used the word scattershot in my headline at the wrap. But again, it's like, even though there were moments where I was like, what is it? You know, I always liked looking at it, you know, and I always liked the energy and the verve of the whole thing. So, yeah, it's not a perfect movie, but, you know, it's definitely one that I think people should see because it's just really energetic.
So what's your number?
I give it a 6.5.
I'm saying 7.2, so our number is 6.9. It's at 65% on the tomato meter. So check that out. Also opening this week, which also has a lot on its mind and tries to get its arms around a lot, is Michael Moore's latest documentary, Fahrenheit 11/9.
Yes.
The title is a takeoff on his Fahrenheit 9/11. And this might be his most powerful movie maybe ever. I mean, definitely in a long time. Definitely since Bowling for Columbine, I would say. And he is trying to understand how we got here. The question that we all ask ourselves every day, all the time, with a Trump presidency, with the multitude of things that are wrong with this country right now, with our democracy in general, how did we get here? And he focuses on a lot of stuff. It's not just the rise of Trump, you know, from a media perspective, and how all the, you know, the cable channels and every newspaper are like glommed onto this larger than life horrific figure because it was good for ratings or right. whatever. It's also equal opportunity in going after the Democratic Party for yes. being in the bag for Hillary and for suppressing, you know, Bernie's support. It is about the Flint water crisis a lot of the time, understandably a topic that is very important to Michael Moore, very mm-hmm. close to his heart, and the corruption that has occurred within the state of Michigan to keep people from surviving, right. from living the healthy lives that they deserve as human beings. And I was always with it, and I didn't know where it was going to go next, and I didn't know how he was going to interconnect these various ideas, and it does feel a little unwieldy, but the anger and the passion behind it are so unmistakable, and I just don't know that it's going to convince anybody to think otherwise. I feel like if you're going to go see a Michael Moore movie about how Trump got elected, that you're probably already on board with wanting to explore that notion from a critical perspective.
I think the goal here is less about trying to change the mind of Trump people, because that has sort of proven to be
impossible.
I think he's trying to gin up the left to go out and vote again. I think he really talks about how 2016, you know, a lot of the reason that the election went the way it did was that Hillary was a divisive figure. She did not compel people to go to the polls the way that Obama did twice. And also that people felt like the Democrats were just offering more business as usual. And he cites the specific example of Obama not really – he never declared Flint a national emergency. He never sent in the Army Corps of Engineers to, like, fix the pipes. He didn't really attack Rick Snyder for letting it all happen. He sort of just kind of turned it into sort of political theater that didn't accomplish anything.
I did not ever know that. The thing that happens with Obama with the water glass and Flint. Yeah, I remember that.
I didn't know that. I somehow missed that one too. I wonder if MSNBC bothered to talk about it or not, you know. So yeah, he's very much like letting both sides have it. But I think he talks about how, and I've been reading Listen Liberal, which is by Thomas Friedman, who wrote What's Wrong with Kansas, or What's the Matter with Kansas. And it is this thing of like the Democrats straying from being the party of the working class, being the party of labor unions, being the party of, you know, non-gajillionaires, you know, that ever since Bill Clinton, you know, that they have just become such a sort of centrist version of what Republicans are, that it turns off a lot of people and they feel like, well, then why bother voting? What's the point if nothing's going to change? So I think the point of this film is that, you know, yeah, the Democrats may be flawed, but you look at the sort of post-2016, you know, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and you know, people like Beto O'Rourke who are stepping up and being boldly progressive and vocal about these issues. And so he's just trying to get those voters who are already on the side of what Michael Moore is on the side of to go out and vote.
Right. And a reminder of, like, how much great work the Parkland kids have had to do.
Yes.
You know, like, that's not necessarily who should have to be taking this over, but they took this over and started a revolution. And the film really celebrates
yes.
that as well, as a reminder of, look, we've got to get behind these kids. These are the ones who are going to be voting now.
Sure. And just, I mean, the Parkland thing has been so fascinating because it's sort of like, everybody else got so numbed to trying to fight the NRA and trying to make a difference after these shootings. It was like when Sandy Hook didn't lead to anything, I think we all sort of threw our hands in the air. I was like, well, all right, fine. We're just never going to – this is just always the way it's going to be. There's nothing to do about it. And the Parkland kids were like, no, I don't accept that paradigm. I don't accept that as an answer. We're going to go after this. We're going to fight for this stuff. And these are kids who, as has been pointed out, were not only raised on social media, but were also raised on Harry Potter and the Hunger Games. So they knew how to, like, get out there and, you know, stir things up. Exactly, yes. And so good on them. And, yeah, the movie does sort of celebrate their efforts and talk about – and, yeah, that the lesson we should all be taking from that is, like, let's just not assume that – anything is settled, and that there's no defeating some of these giant, you know, seemingly insurmountable, you know, organizations or institutional problems or paradigms or whatever. We should go out and rabble rouse.
Yeah. You know? And because it is Michael Moore, you have these really showy moments of theater that he loves and he thrives on, confrontational moments where he pulls up to the governor's mansion in Michigan with a giant water tank with the words Flint water across it
and
giant
sprays the lawn.
And sprays the lawn with the water.
Some of that stuff felt a little phoned in. Like he knows he has to do it at this point, but like when he goes to the state capitol with a glass of Flint water and tries to see the governor and then tries to get the governor's press attaché to drink it, it's like, okay.
You got to play the hits. Come on.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, I've always said that Michael Moore is not much of a documentarian, but he's a hell of a propagandist.
Well, and that's clear from the very beginning. Like, you know, it's vintage Michael Moore, the way he'll juxtapose image with music. So we begin with election night.
Right.
You know, we begin with election night and the high hopes and the people singing along with fight song, you know, Hillary's big campaign song all year long, and just how that night changed tonally. And he has a lot of fun in a very darkly playful way, juxtaposing like those images with songs that like punctuate the emotion of those.
But then at the same time, like later in the film, he does the let's talk about the parallels between Trump and Hitler, which a lot of people feel like, oh, no, we can't. Everybody, why has it always got to be Hitler? Blah, blah, blah. But he really kind of lays it out and was like, oh, yeah, there's a lot. These cats do have a lot in common, whether that's the intent or not.
Right.
You know,
he spells it out in a very surprisingly clear-eyed way from Michael Moore. But then he goes to the tactic of, again, with juxtaposition, laying over the audio of a Trump rally speech with images of Hitler. So is that pushing it? Or is that just another facet of Michael Moore's arsenal?
Yeah, look, I mean, he's a provocateur, and this is the stuff he traffics in. And yeah, at some point, I think everybody reaches a point where they're like, maybe less. but I think he does raise a lot of points, and it is a movie that I think stirs passion, and that's what he's good at. And so, you know, I mean, yeah, Fahrenheit 9/11 did not save us from a second Bush term, but it would be nice if Fahrenheit 11/9 got some people to register and, you know, like out to vote on election day in the midterms at least.
Right. This is why he's releasing it now.
Yeah.
The date is a reference to the first day, the first full day after Trump was elected. And yeah, he's putting it out now with hopes that in what, a month and a half are from the midterms, that it might do some good. So my number is an 8.7. It's unwieldy, but its passion is unmistakable, and he makes a hell of a lot of persuasive points here.
Yeah, I said 7.8. It is, you know, he fires off and he casts lines in a lot of directions, but I think he really does hit on a lot of things that people are thinking about and concerns that we should have and things that we aren't talking about as much. Like, you know, we've stopped talking about Flint as much as we need to be. You know, we've stopped talking about kids in cages. Like the shock doctrine of the Trump era is that there's just always some new horrible thing. And it's like, I you know, yes, I know the Kavanaugh stuff is terrible, but the kids are still in cages and Flint still doesn't have water. You know, it's
Puerto Rico still doesn't have electricity.
Exactly. Yeah. And Syria, you know, like there's just so many things going on at once. It's hard to sort of channel all of your rage. So it's at least nice to have it all in one compact place. Here.
Yes. So our number is an 8.3. It's at 82% on the tomato meter. Please go see it, whether you agree with Michael Moore or not. Perhaps if you don't agree with Michael Moore, even more so, go see it.
Sure.
Also opening wide this week is the kind of YA horror comedy, The House with a Clock in Its Walls.
Which I did not see, but I'm dying to hear about.
I have seen it, and I'll talk about it a little bit. This is a family-friendly adventure from Eli Roth.
Which they've done a very good job of hiding that bit of information.
It was very surprising to me when I looked up on IMDb. I'm like, oh, who directed this? Oh, it's Eli Roth. Because they're putting it out as like Amblin Entertainment. I'm like, wait, so Spielberg produced this, but he didn't direct this.
It wasn't until Bibbs tweeted, okay, who knew that Eli Roth was the director of The House of the Clock and Walls? I was like, this is the first I'm hearing of it.
Yeah, I did not know either. Anyway, but it is It's a very Eli Roth-ish kind of movie in that you can imagine this the kind of movie he would have loved to watch himself as a kid.
Sure.
You know, as a longtime horror filmmaker, it's got some frightening images and ideas to it, but it's also got like a sense of whimsy and like a dark playfulness right. to it. So it is based on a book that I have not read and my child has not read about a little boy named Lewis, played by Owen Vaccaro. The year is 1955. He has been orphaned. There are so many orphans this week. We got a lot of orphans. And so here's yet another one. A young, shy, studious, but kind of precocious orphan who goes to live with his uncle, played by Jack Black. This is an uncle he has never met before, living in a town called New Zebedee, Michigan in 1955. And so he goes to live with them in this giant Victorian that is the stuff of legend. Uncle Jonathan is kind of considered a weirdo in town. Lots of rumors as to who he is and what his deal is. But Lewis settles in with him and Uncle Jonathan's best friend who lives next door, who is named Mrs. Zimmerman and is played by Cate Blanchett. And Cate Blanchett wears a wide variety of fantastic outfits that are all in purple.
Of course.
It's her signature color. So in time, he comes to learn that his uncle and Mrs. Zimmerman are actually a warlock and a witch. And they, in the middle of the night, try to figure out where this ticking sound is coming from. When Lewis first enters the house, he sees that there are clocks everywhere, and there's just the noise of the tick-tock everywhere, every kind of vintage clock. But at night, Uncle Jonathan goes through the walls and goes into different parts of the house, and he's listening. He's trying to figure something out. And we learn that the people who used to live there were a witch couple, witch and warlock couple, Kyle Buchanan. I'm sorry.
Kyle McLaughlin.
Who's Kyle Buchanan? Kyle Buchanan is our friend who writes for New York Times. Although he would make a fabulous witch. I'm sorry. And this is Kyle McLaughlin, who, I don't want to give it all away, but he was trying to do something and no longer lives in the house, but the ticking sound remains. So there's a lot of really creepy imagery in here, right?
I love a good horror movie aimed at children, like Frankenweenie and Paranorman.
Yes, I love Frankenweenie. And this sort of feels like an even more mature kind of Goosebumps.
Okay.
Part of that is because of the presence of Jack Black.
Sure.
And you have...
Who's not in Goosebumps 2? Is that the deal?
Oh, is he not?
I think he's not, but he's in this, which is weird.
Two Spumps, maybe. It's like a two S-E Bumps.
Anyway. I've seen the poster. It's coming out soon.
Well, we will look and figure out who's actually in it. But it's playful, but there's also like stuff that is like legit, the stuff of nightmares.
There's
like
menace.
Evil, like... Evil pumpkins, like beyond silly, playful Tim Burton, you know, Danny Elfman scored pumpkins. This is like they have really sharp teeth and they're really predatory. And there's an entire secret room in the mansion that's nothing but creepy dolls and like doll parts. And like they have weird masks and maybe the torso of them is a machine of some sort. So they're all like twisted, effed up steampunk dolls. but it's a, you know, it's about a little boy who finds his confidence. He learns to channel the magic that is within us all. It kind of falls apart the more the actual like machinations of the plot come together. And then there is literally a machine. And although that's what the part that Nick liked best, I took Nick with me to see it and he was not scared. He's almost nine. He was not scared. But the thing involving the big machine is the part that he actually liked the best. And I kind of like the smaller, more playful use of magic, like to get revenge on bullies or to help you pick up your room or whatever it was. So it's fun and it's clever, but there is definitely that the Eli Roth like strain of darkness, like toying with you, but also really trying to terrify you. And it might be a good first horror film for a lot of kids.
There you go.
So I'm saying 6.6.
Okay.
It's 64% on the tomato meter.
Did you see Justin Chang's review? Because he also pointed out the whole thing about, you know, the orphans in this movie and life itself. He says, one of these is a full-on horror movie, as patently unbelievable as it is genuinely terrifying, full of cheap shocks and torturous metaphysics, and sporting perhaps the most annoying title of the year. The other one, the house with a clock in its walls.
He is good. He is the best of all of us, Justin Chang. So, yes, that's it's good. Yeah. Oh, hold on. What did I just do? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, hold on. Keep talking for a second.
Okay. I mean, I'm hearing you just fine.
Oh, okay. I thought I like.
Did your earphones come out?
I thought I bonked something. We're back. Okay.
No, it's all good.
We're very high tech here at the What the Slate podcast. So also coming out, and I don't want to trash it too extensively, but I wanted to mention, because I had to review this for RogerEbert.com, we have the directorial debut of Judy Greer, who is somebody I always like.
Yes.
You know, she's great as Kitty, the secretary on Arrested Development. She can be great at something more dramatic like The Descendants.
Yes.
And everything in between. She makes every ensemble better. I'm always happy to see her. She has amassed her own tremendous ensemble cast here for a movie called A Happening of Monumental Proportions.
Mm-hmm.
And it features Common, Allison Janney, and Bradley Whitford, but never at the same time, Storm Reid, Katie Holmes, John Cho, Kumail Nanjiani, Rob Riggle.
Wait, you know Allison Janney? You know Allison Janney and Bradley Whitford aren't married. You're thinking of Jane Kasmir.
No, I'm thinking they're both in The West Wing.
Oh, gotcha. Sorry.
There is no West Wing reunion for those of you who missed The West Wing. It never happens.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of times when an actor makes a directorial debut, they have a deep well of friends to get to be in it, and I'm sure Judy Greer has more than most. You know, she's worked so much in so many different kinds of things.
Yeah, and so among the people you have is Nat Faxon, who co-wrote the script for The Descendants and won an Academy Award for it. So it is one of those intertwined lives in Los Angeles movies where all these people are connected and it takes place over the space of a day. It takes place mostly at a company and at a school, and everyone is connected somehow. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even going to trouble you with the plot, but basically nobody ever feels like a real person. Not unlike life itself, it does try to depict some pretty serious heavy-duty life moments, like the loss of a job and a divorce and a suicide attempt. And there's another dead mom. And just there's a lot going on here.
Did she write it as well or no?
She did not. Okay. Someone named Greg Lundy wrote it. I really don't know what she saw in this material. Because she seems to have pretty good taste when it comes to choosing the project she works on in front of the camera.
Sure.
So I don't really know what it was about this story that appealed to her. There's also this really obnoxious, jaunty music to accompany everything. Mm. The movie begins with Allison Janney and Rob Riggle play the administrators at this private school in Los Angeles, and they discover the dead body of a gardener on campus on the morning of career day. And it's, what do they do? It's like they're lugging the dead body up the stairs, take it to the teacher's lounge, and it's like, wacky music. And Katie Holmes and Nat Faxon are the ambulance drivers, the EMTs who come, and they don't really help. And Common is having an affair. Oh, Jennifer Garner's in this. Common's having an affair with Jennifer Garner, and Bradley Whitford is Common's boss who fires him. And anyway, they're all supposed to achieve some kind of mystical sense of understanding and humanity by the end, and it just, again, never rings true. So, Judy Greer, I admire that you are trying to branch out and do other things. I admire your ability to gather a pretty impressive lineup of talent. I wish you had given them something better to do. So my number is at 1.5. It's at 13% on Tomato Meter.
We're rooting for you, Judy Greer. We're all rooting for you.
We are. We really like you. Also, we should mention we have a tad bit of movie news to discuss, and that is that the next James Bond movie has a director.
Yes.
And it's Cary Fukunaga.
Yes.
This has caused great consternation throughout film Twitter and the internet in general.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen a lot of enthusiasm and also a lot of skittishness and, a lot of people predicting that he will quit.
Why?
Because the Broccolis are worse than Marvel when it comes to, we're really not interested in your little auteur ideas. We know what we're doing here, and we have a house style, and we expect you to remain within it, you know. You'll get occasionally a Sam Mendes or a, who am I thinking of?
I don't know. Somebody good.
Yeah, the guy who directed Coal Miner's Daughter.
Michael Apted.
Stepping up. But for the most part, you get people who were editors, you know, or people who were second unit directors on earlier Bond films, because they really, you know, they're not looking for somebody to put their own stamp on the material. It's like a TV series, basically. You know, they'll hire different directors to come in and do stuff. But like Rob Zombie did this great interview on the Bret Easton Ellis podcast one time where he talked about how he directed an episode of television to sort of learn what that was like, and very soon discovered that, like, it kind of does itself for the most part. Right. I mean, that was his perspective. There are, I think, some TV directors who do kind of have a visual style or can put their stamp on a long-running TV show. But for the most part, you know, they've got to look down. They've got the camera set the way they've got the camera set. And the actors know what they're doing. They've been playing these characters for years, you know. So I think it's kind of the same thing with 007. They're not really looking to hire somebody who's going to, you know, start from scratch and reinvent it. Exactly.
You're not going to get like Michel Gondry's 007.
Exactly. Which is not to say that they haven't rebooted themselves over the years. I mean, Casino Royale obviously was a big breakaway from the past. But yeah, I'll be curious to see if Fukunaga stays.
Well, I just think of, like, there's a kind of gauzy artistry, and there's an intimacy and a humanity to his films. If you look at Sin Nombre, if you look at his Jane Eyre, they're gorgeously shot, and they're really immersive in terms of mood. And I haven't really watched a whole lot of True Detective. I know he's done quite a bit of that, but I don't necessarily think of that as a show with a whole lot of big action set pieces.
Not really. I mean, True Detective, I mean, season one was, I think, the one that he definitely directed. I can't remember if he did two or not, but it's more character based with some sort of actiony moments or, you know, whatever, but nothing to the extent of what you would see in a Bond movie.
Right. Well, I think it's a really bold choice, and I hope he stays on, and I hope he's able to maintain some semblance of his own style.
Yeah, no, I like him a lot. I just don't know if this is the right fit for what they want and for what he wants.
Yes. Well, we will keep track of that, of course. And then coming up next week, it's another really busy week, as they are all going to be. Night School is coming out next week with Tiffany Haddish and Kevin Hart.
Yep.
And Smallfoot, which I have seen. Have you seen?
I have seen it.
Okay. And The Old Man and the Gun. Have you seen that yet?
No, I'm seeing it this week.
I'm also seeing it this week. So it's a pretty busy week once again. And we will have all of that for you.
And we are going to have Ben back one of these days. And I'm hoping when that happens, he and I can get a little caught up on Better Call Saul, because we haven't had a chance to talk about that in a while.
Oh, yeah. There's television.
Yes.
Television exists, too. How many episodes have there been of Better Call Saul at this point?
I don't know how many total, but there's been four since the last time we talked about it. So
okay.
We'll have some catching up to do. And Matt is not here this week, but you can catch him and me on the Schmodown. We're currently participating in the Anarchy Tournament, and our first round just posted, I think, this week on YouTube and on their Patreon page. So if you want to see Matt and me answering movie trivia questions.
Did you win?
I'm not going to say.
Oh, you can't say.
Well, I can. I mean, it's out there, but I just don't want people who haven't seen it yet, I don't want to spoil it for them. But our team name is The Paddington 2.
Cute.
Thank you. So, you know, it's very exciting.
Okay, well, check them out there and check us out here. Thank you. And we keep thanking you, but we really do appreciate all of you.
Yes.
We've gotten a lot of questions about where's the podcast this week, because we did it on a Friday this week instead of a Thursday. So we are just thrilled that you care and that you're listening. And as Alonzo said off the top, we will definitely still work on getting it up on a platform of some sort. But for now, you can put me in your pocket and take me with you to the laundromat from my own little website. So
she fits.
I'm tiny. Have a great weekend, you guys. Thank you so much for everything. And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.